Our meeting will come to order. This is Thursday, February 19th. Our Education Innovation Policy Committee has a quorum. Members, today we're going to hear three bills. We're going to finish Erdahl's tax credit bill and then move to Representative Mariani and end with Representative Aaron Murphy. So we're going to have a very, very informative day because we're going to hear about tax credits, and then we're going to move to compulsory school attendance age increased and end with preschool and the four-year-old program that many around here are supporting. So with that, Representative Erdahl, would you return to the testifying table, please? And members, I will take House File 245 from the table. And Representative Erdahl, I will renew your motion that 245, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. Good morning. How are you?
Well, if you want the truth, I have a cold and I'm not feeling very well. But otherwise, it's a great day.
So will you introduce yourself, and then you can always start with a story if you like.
Well, of course, I'm Representative Dean Erdahl, and we have House File 245, which we, I think, pretty much got through.
Why don't you review it for the sake of those who are listening to our recording?
Yes. This bill provides a tax credit of $2,500 for those teachers who get a master's degree in their content area, in other words, in the area in which they teach. The basic premise behind this is that since some studies show only about 2 in 5 teachers in Minnesota who get master's degrees get them in their content area, that it would be wise to encourage more teachers to actually get advanced training in what they teach, the concept being that if you know more about what you're teaching, you should be a better teacher.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. What might happen in other states? Are there master's programs for content for teachers?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know if other states have this or not. As I said last time, I've been thinking about how best to do this for maybe about 5 years. And finally came up with the tax incentive as the best way, or the tax credit as the best way to incentivize. I considered, and I don't know if other states are doing them, but I considered maybe only giving a partial lane change for those who didn't get in their content area, and looked at other different ways, but this seemed to be the one that worked the best. Whether another state does it or not, it seemed to be something that we could do here.
In states where there's tiered licensure, a master's degree counts toward the probably the next tier for reasons of salary increase. So that's available, but whether or not it's a credit. But Representative Urusso, maybe you know. Are you ready for your question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's not to that point, but so in some of the content areas, it's fairly obvious, certain degrees would apply. But then you get beyond that, in biology, there's a whole range of degrees. In social studies, there's a whole range of degrees. Even math, a person might have one in statistics or actuarial science or something. So have you thought about who would establish which degrees would qualify as being directly related?
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Russo. it's excuse me, a good point to bring up. And in doing some checking on that as to does it address in the bill, actually it probably does. I believe that, and maybe Ms. Larson can help. I don't see Ms. Manzi here today. But I think the Department of Administration, I believe, prepares the forms and goes through this and would make a determination if the qualifications were met. However, why it's a good question for you to bring up, technically, they're doing that after the fact. And I think it's important that we do have something before. And so, as an amendment for the next stop, I will place something in this bill where the local school board, perhaps, or if it's determined that the Board of Teaching is better to do it, we will make a determination that someone prior to entering the master's program will make a decision.
Ms. Larson, did you have a comment to make?
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative Erdahl, I understand in the most superficial way that how the credit is administered through the Department of Revenue is that individual taxpayers who are eligible for the credit submit documentation to qualify for the credit, and the check in that circumstance is the possibility of an audit, which is why Representative Erdahl, I believe, is concerned about ensuring that, in fact, from the outset, the teacher is pursuing a content area consistent with the intent of the legislation.
Are there other questions?
I will, Madam Chair, thank Ms. Larson for clarifying, because my mind is a little cloudier than it was yesterday when I read that.
Representative Mariani, you had a question for Representative Erdahl. He's engaged there.
I think.
Representative Urusso, what different masters are there available in the areas that you're familiar with, for example, science or math?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, for math, as I mentioned, it could be mathematics, statistics, actuarial science. Some of the mathematics departments also are combined with computer science, so there might be a little bit of bleed over there. In chemistry, it could be chemistry or biochemistry. That one's fairly straightforward. Or perhaps it's unlikely someone would be pursuing food chemistry or something like that. In biology, could be biology, microbiology. Social studies, I think, is probably the most complicated, as you would know, because you could start out with sociology, history, anthropology,
economics.
You know, would you allow it to be some specialized history area? You know, I mean, there's art history and things like that. So it really would require someone who's familiar with the discipline areas to judge, and so it might be better suited if it was someone from education, the Board of Teaching or a school board or someone like that, that would be thinking that through.
Thank you for giving us some time to get Representative Mariani seated again. I called to you, but you were engaged in the audience, and I didn't want to interrupt you. So I knew Representative Yusaro could enlighten us a little bit. So did you have a question for Representative Erdahl that you've thought of yet? Or Representative Dabney, you had a question last Tuesday for Representative Erdahl.
And Madam Chair, you actually expect me to remember it?
Madam Chair, I believe Representative Dabney did get his question asked.
Well, let's go to Representative Bennett while Representative Mariani tries to recall.
Don't let them think too hard, Madam
Chair. Oh, yes, Representative Erdahl. When we get you at the table, we like to have some fun. Okay. Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Erdahl. This is a worthy bill, and I always like to see encouraging teachers to further their education, and especially in their area. One question I have, and I guess more of a comment to keep in mind, not sure how this would work into this, but when teachers are attempting to better themselves, and I'm thinking as an elementary school teacher, we have many subjects, of course, but let's say I was wanting to better myself, I'm teaching first grade and I want to get my special ed master's, which is not related to what I'm teaching then, but it would definitely help. You know, it's a licensure area that is a good one to have, as well as it's one that we have vacancies in right now. But would we be able to work around that somehow, or would that just not be part of this?
Representative Erdahl.
Madam Chair, Representative Bennett, the way it's structured right now, it would be in something that you are teaching. Now, I guess I'll just leave it at that right now. I mean, there may be some ways to, to get around this. I mean, if there's a if they need a special ed teacher, and you are teaching special ed students in your class, I mean, there may be ways to work around that.
Madam Chair,
yes,
just as a thought, don't know how this would work, but if you could add some wording in that it was related to an area that you're teaching in, or possibly related to an area where there are shortages of licensures, maybe that would help. I don't know, or maybe it doesn't belong in this bill, but that's just a thought.
All right, thank you.
Well, one thing you might want to consider, Representative Erdahl, is in some way working it into the teacher's improvement plan or the plans that now they create as they work through teacher evaluation or to improve themselves. Maybe, you know, they could have that as part of the evaluation plan, that a teacher is in a particular area now but has a keen interest in another area in earning an advanced degree, such as Representative Bennett mentioned, moving from, elementary ed to special education. I think there are ways to work this out with school boards.
I think there are ways to look at it. I don't want to get too far afield from the original intent, which is
right, a tax credit.
A tax credit on the awarded in the content area. Mm-hmm. But if there are ways to accommodate some other needs, we can look at those too.
Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's just more of a comment from personal experience, and I want to applaud Representative Erdahl for bringing this forward. I think this just promotes and encourages lifelong learning. My mother was an English to speakers of other languages teacher, and while I was going to college, she was motivated to get her master's degree in that area. And I think, regardless of the pay scale adjustments, the investment that one takes in order to get that education is high, the costs are high, and any way we can promote and encourage that, she ended up teaching for 14 years beyond me getting out of college, and so she applied all those new knowledges, new practices, and new skills to many, many students in the school districts that she served. And so this is a great way to promote and encourage that.
Thank you very much. Representative Mariani, are you ready with your question yet? You can keep thinking.
It takes me a few hours to get my brain fired up on any given day. Madam Chair, I just want to echo Representative Bennett's compliments of Representative Erdahl's effort here. Yesterday I met with four or five superintendents from Southwest Minnesota, and one of their top issues, has to do with overall teacher shortage, but also access to a teaching core with advanced content knowledge. I think that's critical across the state, but I think it's particularly critical for many of our smaller school districts throughout Minnesota, and I think anything that we can do to set our existing core to be able to add to their credentials is just a really, really good idea. So if I'm not on your bill, I'll get on it, Representative.
And
yeah, really.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Erdahl. I really appreciate you doing this too, because you've been working on this for a while, and I really appreciate the other comments and how we can expand this, but perhaps that would what we're talking about needs to be in another bill to so that you have the opportunity to really fulfill what you've been working on, which I think needs to be the target to help teachers improve in their skill in their target in their teaching area. You've given them a good incentive, and I like the ideas of, as part of the teacher evaluation, can we have some goals, some opportunities, and perhaps I think rather than complicating Representative Erdahl's bill, to do a separate bill that would talk about other ways, particularly to get into areas that we have shortages, just as we're talking about incentivizing people to get into rural Minnesota for not only education, but other professions, that we should maybe help people think about that as well. So I applaud what you're doing and support it totally.
Thank you.
Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for letting me have so much time on this one. I think we have a bill about loan forgiveness for shortage areas, for starters. But I also would really, I really appreciate this bill. In high school in particular, students really, they really need to feel like, you know, the adults around them are competent and legitimate. And when someone does a master's degree in their program, they're going to be exposed to the current research and really be able to speak with more authority about the subject. So I think that's very motivating for high school students. So thank you for bringing it.
Well said, and that's really true. We teachers want to be a little bit more educated than our students when we're teaching them, and so getting a master's degree in a content is really good. Closing comments, Representative Erdahl?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. It's just a simple little bill that tries to make a difference, I hope, in elevating the profession that we so value in Minnesota.
With that, Representative Erdahl, I'll renew your motion that House File 245, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and House File 245 is on its way to Education Finance. Representative Mariani. House File 15, everyone, a compulsory school attendance age increase. Welcome, Chair Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, members. I would echo Representative Erdahl's message. This is a simple little bill. I thought I would try that.
Please say your name for the record, Representative Mariani, even though we've been using your name repeatedly this morning, as long as it's your bill, and then please move your bill.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlos Mariani, and I would move, and Madam Chair, what would be the appropriate motion for today?
To layover.
Sorry, I would, and I'm sorry, our house number is?
House File 15.
Thank you. I would move that House File 15 be recommended and passed with the intent that we'll lay this over for possible inclusion.
Representative Mariani moves House File 15 to be laid over and considered in an omnibus bill. Please proceed to explain your House File 15.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It really is a simple bill in terms of what it technically does. It raises the maximum compulsory school attendance age to 18. I'll make some very brief comments. I do have a testifier, and then I've asked the page to distribute a letter of support from our county attorney in Ramsey County, John Choi, on this issue. Madam Chair, members, to date, 22 states and the District of Columbia have set the maximum compulsory school age at 18. That's nearly half of the states in our union. At least 12 of those states raised their compulsory school attendance within the last 10 years. And it's really quite diverse. Alabama, Colorado, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, South Dakota, West Virginia, and some others. In 2013, Minnesota raised its compulsory age from 16 to 17. So we were part of a little less than a third of the states that had the lowest compulsory age requirement. And of those 12 states that have made this move in the last 10 years, the majority of them have jumped from either 17 to 18 or 16 to 18. And then beginning in 2015-16, Kentucky will allow school districts to raise the dropout age from 16 to 18. So their approach in that state is to basically allow each school district to make that decision. And I believe their legislation would at some point make it universal across the state if enough school districts do this. In other words, they've set like a tipping point number. So why will we do this? Really quite simply, and the arguments have been consistent across the states and legislatures, that's really tied to the economic growth and sustainability of our states. And the reason that is because of the access to the higher skills that are acquired once someone moves beyond high school. I grew up in an era where the high school diploma was the goal. We had lots of older cousins in my family who upon receiving their high school diploma, I grew up in Chicago, immediately got some really good paying jobs in the steel mills in and around Lake Michigan. That was pretty much the scenario across our nation for many, many decades, as we were heavily at manufacturing based, different skill base. I don't want to say low skill, because those are skills, but a different skill based society. They were able to live a comfortable life, own homes, be successful with their children, etc. That's really, really difficult to do nowadays. Even if you're entering into the manufacturing sector across here and across the nation, your ability to be competitive as an employer really does depend on having skills that are attained through some kind of post-secondary program. So we often talk about college here, and I know, you know, some people sort of revolt. Well, not everyone's cut out for college, you know, that kind of thing. And that's because we have this idea that college really is purely about academic, intellectual content. I'm looking at Jim Dabney, our intellect, and he didn't know he was our intellect. So, but frankly, post-secondary experience increasingly, I would argue, and should, be an exposure to a wide variety of skills, including skills that fall under what we call career tech. So, members, in terms of economic well-being for states, high school diplomas and college, there's a difference that's pretty dramatic in terms of medium income between high school diplomas and college degrees. In 2011, U.S. adults with just a high school diploma could expect the median income was $26,699, as opposed to those with a bachelor's degree of $48,309. If you were to go on to a graduate degree, that jumps even more to $64,322. Poverty rates are obviously involved here, and states with the lowest rates of post-secondary accreditation acquired by students also tend to be the states with the largest percentage of people living in poverty, whereas other states are opposite of that. We tend to be, Madam Chair, in that latter category. It is true. Relative to many other states, we have a much more highly educated workforce and populace. However, we have a couple things that are happening. One is that because we're a big state with a lot of diversity, once we disaggregate that information, those realities almost really become reversed. So in many low-income communities, many isolated students that come from geographically isolated communities and communities of color, the poverty rates zoom, the income levels drop, and there's a close correlation with post-secondary accreditation. So we do sort of have this little hidden problem, and those are precisely the communities that we're going to depend on to be able to move successfully beyond high school. So members, I'll stop there. We've got some other thoughts as well, but I really want an opportunity for my testify, Madam Chair, Superintendent Valeria Silva from St. Paul Schools, to share some thoughts on this issue.
Welcome to our committee, Superintendent Silva. Great to see you. Please introduce yourself and begin.
My name is Valeria Silva. I'm the superintendent, proud superintendent of St. Paul Public Schools. Madam Chair, members of the committee, today I'm here to help you to understand the importance of raising the mandatory age to the 18 years old. As many of you know, our district serves a very diverse population of students, and we have over 100 languages, over 39,000 students, and 73% free or reduced lunch, and not in decreasing, but increasing. And we have over 35% of our students are ELL, which means that they come to our schools with other language than English. And I think, Madam Chair, you had the experience to see that in one of our schools. And in our short conversation, you can see how lucky we are in St. Paul to have such a diverse population of students. And we, as the St. Paul Public School, regardless of a student preparation for a school, we are preparing them for graduation. And when we look at what we have done as a school district and what you have done a couple years ago, when you help us to raise or you provide us with the opportunity to raise it from 16 to 17. I really want to thank you because it meant a difference for many students. And I'll tell you the story a little bit more about he had some statistics, but I do believe, and we do believe, that moving from 17 to 18 will be removing some of the system barriers that we have. As Representative Mariani said, 20 years ago, not having a high school diploma was okay. You could have a job. Nowadays, most of the pieces that you see, if you don't have a high school diploma, you would be making, and that's interesting data, $800,000 less in your lifetime. So I am proud to say that our recent data in St. Bobo schools have shown us that specifically last year, 74% of our students graduated in 4 years. And that's the traditional graduation rate most students follow. 19% of them are continuing higher education, high school, and 7% dropped out. Black students in St. Paul have higher graduation rate than the state average for all the comprehensive high schools, for exception of one. 13 to 31 points higher than the state average for black students. ELL students are also higher the graduation rate that we have for the state, and from 11 to 32 points higher. This has helped us to reduce the racial disparities, but we still have this incredible gap in graduation. We have 83% of our white students graduating in 4 years, when only 51% of our American Indians, 67% of our Latino students, and 65% of our black students, and 76% of our Asian students are graduating in 4 years in St. Paul. So what we do believe that having the opportunity to move this compulsory age to 18 will give us the opportunity as the St. Paul Public School to help many of the families. I have the luxury to speak another language, and I had had many Latino families, they come to me, and they, in Spanish usually, they said, what can I do to push my child, 17 years old, to continue school, and then how does the law can help, and how can you provide us help? The parents, many parents know that that's the goal, but they do not know how to do it. And this will help many of the parents. We had the luxury since October last year that we have 17 students, as you see, there are not that many that they were over 17 that they graduated, or 15 students that they're over 17 that they graduated, and due to the fact that you moved the compensatory age, the mandatory age, from 16 to 17. So, and we also see that in truancy, and that truancy is something that affects all of us. If we don't pay now, we will pay later. And we believe that the number of students we will be affected is not that great if you're worried about the economical impact, but it will be saving the opportunity for us not to put some of our students and our young adults in situation in which they will be without a high school diploma. Last Tuesday, which it was yesterday or 2 days ago, and we're in the board meeting, and this is just they have the public comment, and we have one student, was two, but one of the students that came in and talk about how important it was for that student to come and talk about Project Return, which is a project we have in order to go and reach out. And he talked about how his twin sister graduated from high school and he didn't, and how bad he felt, and he used the terminology, I'm the man, you know, how the kids feel that because there are males or females, they have different roles, which is unbelievable sometimes. And the student said, I'm going to graduate in a couple of weeks, and the pride in that student's face and the ability to just feel that he could do something else and thinking about his possibilities would warm up any of you. We are asking for you today to consider the opportunity to provide different opportunities for our students and our families that will encourage them to continue working towards getting a high school diploma.
Thank you, Superintendent Silva. I'm looking at the third page of your handout where you have the graphics on graduation, noting the increases in all of your high schools, at least in from Central through Harding, and you note it's from 2012, so was that prior to our changing the compulsory age?
Yes.
So you were making strides before we even changed.
Madam Chair, very yes, good. Absolutely. And then I do believe that we will continue. That we have a project freshman in our district, which is pushing and getting our students prepared. We have work with a truancy even deeper that we have worked before. We have worked towards encouraging the families to understand the value of graduating on time and also applying to colleges. You can see it in the air. Our kids don't have just the goal of graduation. They have the goal of having a post-secondary education, and it does not have to be a four-year degree.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Becerra.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a few questions for Representative Mariani. Because I don't know the history, and I'm wondering if you could fill me in, how long, and this may have already been mentioned, but how long was it at 16? And what was the reasoning for establishing 16, if you're aware?
Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, I'm not aware. I can speculate just a little bit here. It's been at 16 for a long time. And I suspect, quite frankly, it reflected some of the things that I alluded to earlier, that in a heavily agricultural manufacturing based society, the idea was less about new higher order skills, if you will, even to do manufacturing, which now you need to do. And so I suspect the wisdom, and I think it was correct at that time, is that if young people at that age are willing to join the workforce, they probably have the skills to do that at this time effectively. Now the big question on the table is questioning whether they do have the skills relative to this economy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple follow-ups here.
Yes, please.
A couple questions, so thank you. And that makes sense, you know, as cultures change, as capabilities change, et cetera, we need to, it's our duty to ensure that we adapt to the new demands of society. Do you know approximately how many students this will impact at the age 17? So going from 17 to 18, how many students currently decide not to continue on in high school statewide?
Madam Chair, that's an excellent question. I'm not prepared to answer that, but that is a easily discernible number. We certainly were able to pull those projections up. Excuse me, when we did the move from 16 to 17. I apologize, I don't have that info before us. And quite frankly, Madam Chair, that does kind of beg another question about a fiscal impact for the bill, because there will be, since we have a foundation formula that's based on student enrollment numbers.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Becerra.
The next question. So I teach college, and one of the things that makes it easier for me to disseminate information with a classroom full of students is they want to be there. They are there by choice, and when they're there by choice, they have a mindset that's receptive to learning, etc. I have a concern that when we force people to be there, especially when they're nearing or almost at the age of an adult, they have other capabilities. They're presumably able to drive, and a whole host of things that come along with that age, that they don't want to be there. And if they're not there and they're not receptive to learning, that they may create a greater hindrance to other students, to the teachers, etc. And I'm receptive as well to the the high school diploma, but if there's the mental mindset isn't there, right? We can't force people to, just because we put them in the seat, that their willingness to learn. And it may take a couple years. So somebody may graduate from, or not graduate from high school, but then they mature mentally in a few years from now, or from that time, they have the GED available to them. They can always go back and get the equivalent of that and move on to a career or college at that point. So that's more of a comment. Then the last question I would have, Madam Chair, and Representative Mariani.
Representative Lucero.
What will the impact be on this bill, so moving from 17 to 18, on homeschooling, if any? Thank you.
Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, I'll do the last, the second question first, and then I want to speak, and I'll try to be very brief, because Representative Lucero raises a major question that is always raised, and actually appropriately so, relative to this issue. Under homeschool, the requirement would be that students, so homeschool parents would currently now have to administer a nationally norm reference standardized achievement exam for their students up to 17. They would need to do that for their students up to 18. They also need to report academic outcomes to local superintendents. So they would now be required to do that reporting out to 18 as opposed to 17. Madam Chair, on the first part of the question, and I will try to be very brief because it's a big question, I think you're absolutely correct about the concern that we now have 17-year-olds who simply don't want to be here, and what does that set up in terms of the learning environment. I think we're learning some things about moving from 16 to 17 in that regard. I know some districts, St. Paul is one, Representative Dabney's district, Minneapolis is another, I suspect there are others as well, have been doing dropout recovery efforts. And I raise that because there's two ways, really, I think, to answer this question, to be very responsible with it. One is for us as the legislature to say, you know, we're already compelling, if you will, students to be in the classroom, and new school districts need to deal with that issue. Structure yourselves accordingly, you know, et cetera. And so we can certainly just simply say, you know, it's out to 18, keep doing what you're doing in programs like St. Paul's, the Project Return, et cetera, and adapt those, you know, to regular classroom time, if you will. And so in other words, it would be an expectation of the state that school districts, you need to do things differently, because this is so important to us that we want to keep these students here that much longer. The other, quite frankly, approach is some other districts have done, or rather, Madam Chair, some other states have done this. I've not done this in this bill, and I'm certainly open to do it, but it would require more appropriations kind of issues here. Some other states, Georgia in particular, led the way. Massachusetts, I believe, did this following on the heels of Georgia, have created state appropriations in order to assist school districts to do that. So what Georgia did is they created graduation coaches, a whole category within the Council Core, and made a commitment to place at least one of those in every district around the state. So in other words, it's a recognition on the part of the state that we're going to have to do some different interventions, as reflected, you know, in the Project Return, and it's worth our investment as a state to be able to support those kind of efforts. But you're absolutely correct. I think there's certainly, you know, this issue of, you know, dealing with individuals who just don't want to be there, and we're the adults in society who are saying, you know, at 17, you're really making a bad call here, guy. You know, and we really want you to be here for your own good and for all our good. And again, you know, we can either just let the school districts deal with how to adjust, change their learning environments to make those much more receptive for students, and or we can also invest in school districts to make that possible.
Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a follow-up off of Representative Lucero's question, and I appreciate the explanation of how it would affect homeschoolers, but just a comment that, you know, having been homeschooled and knowing a lot of other homeschool families, that I believe there would be a concern there with increasing the compulsory age to 18. Most homeschool students have a more flexible schedule as far as completing their coursework. A lot of them are involved in dual enrollment type programs and participating in such things as PSEO. And a lot of them graduate at a younger age than 18, just because of the accelerated pathway that they have. So I do have concerns about that piece, and just something to keep in mind going forward.
Representative Mariani.
Very quickly, I think if we were to move forward with this, I certainly am open to working out, doing some workouts with you and the homeschool community. I don't want to diminish the importance of homeschool. We've established that as a presence in our state, and I think for the most part that's worked out very well for us. Mm-hmm. But I do want to remind committee members that the vast majority of 17-year-olds are not in a homeschooled environment. Mm-hmm. And so in terms of scale issues, I think, you know, I want us to really pause and think about, you know, as we channel, you know, close to 800,000 plus kids through our regular, you know, public school system, that we should consider that system being adjusted in order to capture students beyond the age of 17. But I'll certainly work with you in terms of some workouts with homeschool.
Representative Yarusso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Isn't the last question a little bit of a moot point, because isn't graduation one of the lawful reasons to withdraw already? So that it really wouldn't require an extra accommodation for homeschool students if they've fulfilled all the requirements for graduation.
Chair,
Representative Mariani.
I would defer to legal counsel just to make sure that I don't
Ms. Larson, do you want to affirm that rather than just shake your head?
Madam Chair, Representative Yarusso, yes.
Thank you. Do you have any other testifiers to support your... I'm going to call forward yes. Representative Ward, do you have a pressing question? Sure, go ahead.
Yes or no? What's pressing? Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome.
And just the clarification on the bill, it is until the child has graduated.
Yes.
So that language is in there in statute already. So that isn't the question. If you finish at 14, you're done, and you can go on to other things. So there's really not an age requirement. But I think what we're doing is establishing the culture of expectation
mm-hmm.
for being in school. And that extra year of brain development, maturity, gives kids an awfully lot more than just the academic preparation that we're doing. It gives them another year to grow up and help make better decisions in their lives. So I really appreciate your doing this.
Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try and be brief. I'm just wondering, you mentioned earlier, and I may have missed it, the specific state, but there's a state that did this and gave the local school districts a choice. And I'm just wondering your thoughts on that, if you'd be willing to maybe do something like that here. I just personally think that's a great model. If, you know, it try it out in various school districts, if they like it, you know, eventually it goes throughout the whole state.
Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, that state is Kentucky. I believe it's Kentucky.
Yes, you said earlier it was Kentucky.
I certainly am open to exploring that.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you.
I think we have Representative Bly. Last question, because we have to get to another bill, and we have some other testifiers.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Mariani, having worked in alternative programs and other places, I sometimes have a different view of these things, and I do appreciate the way that you've talked about this and that you recognize that there are some students that have a different path. And I think some of what we've seen over the past few years with really a kind of a standardization of things, it becomes more difficult for some students to sort of fit, because they are different, not all the same. So I know of students who could use perhaps a couple of years or a year away from school to really value school, and not to be negative about either the student or the school, but So I'm really encouraged by your comment about the districts need to come up with ways of dealing with this issue, and certainly alternative schools and ALCs were that kind of programming or whatever, and there are things out there. But I think we need to think specifically about the needs of certain students and what kind of programs might fit them, and be more creative about that and not be so stifled by our need to have everyone be the same, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, Madam
Representative Mariani.
Representative Bly, absolutely, and that's why I referenced that. I think it would be a critical mistake for school districts if we were to pass this to just continue to do what they're currently doing, so to speak, with this category of students. You know, thank God we've had alternative schools. I think they have really helped to ensure that a certain percentage of students have been able to go on successfully with their high school diploma. I would point out John Choi's letter here, and he was very careful about this. He wasn't, you know, he didn't want to malign high school dropouts in terms of they're all going to be criminals. But he did. He does argue, and he's an expert because, you know, he's the one who's handling prosecutions in our county, that there is a higher rate of incidents with high school mm-hmm. dropouts and a number of unfortunate decisions that can lead to the adjudication in the correction system. And so the real issue here then becomes, what risk are we willing to run? Some students may take a year or two. I've met those kind of students, and they've gone on, they've been fine. But I've also met lots of other students that have dropped out and have wound up in John Choi's courtrooms.
Thank you, Superintendent Silva. Great to have you here. I believe the School Boards Association, and there's a principal in the audience who would like to express some concerns about House File.
Madam Chair?
Yes,
could I just
Representative Silva. I mean, Representative.
No, I'm not going into politics.
Superintendent Silva.
That's your job.
Yes.
I just wanted to talk about the alternative programs, and I think Representative Lucero talked about that today. Is that Lucero?
Yes.
Yes, okay. I'm using my Spanish a little bit. But the thing is, I will invite you to come to Gorton Parks, our alternative program, because it's so different from what people perceive as an ALC. And I would love to take anybody who is available. Not only is it a beautiful place, but how we have approached the students from they were not successful in high school. High school, the traditional high school did not work for them. So we need to think about that many of the students, the traditional high school, it wasn't the right fit. And we need to think that our kids are very different, and we need to find the fit. Because not only the fit is going to help us, society is going to help all of us. And as you said, it's an issue with crime, it's an issue with income tax, it's an issue all over. So if anybody has a couple hours, because it will be about an hour if you are willing to come and visit our Gorton Parks, our LEAP, or our Agape program, we will be glad to give you a tour. And just let us know.
Thank you, Superintendent Silva. I look forward to that visit. School Boards Association and the principal from Big Lake, please come forward. Please say your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Good morning, committee. I'm Madam Chair, my name is Snezhana Besanov, and I'm here on behalf of Minnesota School Boards Association. We work with school boards from across the state of every size and location, small, large, urban, and rural. Representative Mariani and MSBA share the same desire for educating all of Minnesota's students. We agree that regular school attendance is directly related to students' success in academic work, benefits students socially, provides opportunities for important communication between teacher and student, and establishes regular habits of dependability, which are important to the future of all students. As an organization, MSBA helps school districts by providing model student attendance and truancy policies to ensure regular and consistent attendance. MSBA's concerns with this well-intentioned proposal is that requiring a 17-year-old who is adamantly opposed to being in school to stay in school may have unintended consequences of taking away learning opportunities from other students who want to be there by disrupting classes and creating unpleasant educational atmosphere in classroom and in the school building. This proposal would not prevent habitual truancy and would kick in a truancy process, which may result in increased workload and expense by district and the county. Not all schools are for all students, as we've just heard a little bit earlier. some students would benefit from different options when regular school does not work for them, including getting help with the issues that they may be dealing with at that time in their life. We believe that school districts need to have the resources so they can allocate them as needed to programs to help students in creative ways to stay in school, not just by mandating them to do so involuntarily. This mandatory age increase was proposed in 2013 legislative session. It was a bit controversial, especially in the other body. As a result, a compromise was made to increase this mandatory age from 16 to 17, starting this school year. So it hasn't even been a year since it's been in place. So we would suggest that you allow this compromise to play out and really permit the high school principals to bring forth their recommendations before moving on this legislation and mandatory and requiring this mandatory attendance. Thank you, Madam Chair, and the committee for your time and consideration of MSBA's concerns.
Thank you. And Principal Dockendorf, would you introduce yourself and begin your testimony?
Good morning, everyone. Good morning, Madam Chair. First of all, I'd like to just share a little bit of who
I am.
Would
you say your name for the record,
please? Oh, I'm sorry. Bob Dockendorf, high school principal, Big Lake. I've been in education 25 years. I spent 8 years as assistant principal, and I'm on my eighth year as principal. And I'd like to tell you a little bit about the size of our school and about our school. We have 1,000 students. The students in Big Lake, we currently have approximately 38 to 40% free and reduced. We have a graduation rate in the mid 80%. We have a attendance rate of about 90 to 92, depending on the year. I've been there a long time. Some of my colleagues were going to be here today, Principal Driver from St. Michael Albertville and Principal Mischke, which I believe you have a letter before you from him. But those two are currently on their way to the Girls State High School tournament, hockey tournament, so they couldn't be here. Had a chance to talk with them. I also had a chance to talk with Monticello High School principal yesterday, Joel Lundin. The first note I'd like to point out is, and it's been discussed here, is that the compulsory attendance has just moved from 16 to 17, and it's our opinion, and I'm also here representing Minnesota Association of Secondary School Principals, which is approximately 1,200 secondary school principals. We haven't had an opportunity to see what has occurred or follow the data from when it was 16 years old to now 17. And then to jump to 18, I think, is a bit rushed. I'd also like to tell you a little bit about how our area schools differ from inner city schools. We have, and it's becoming more and more, we have families that have businesses. We have construction businesses. We have manufacturing businesses. We have still have plenty of farms in the area where students, when they hit a certain age, have been working their whole life to go back to work with those with their family businesses. Another point that was brought up this morning, I'd like to touch on it, is if we would move the age to 18, the compulsory attendance age, we're talking about a different type of student. From the legislature all the way to the schools, we talk about and we create individualized learning plans for these students. These are individuals. These are independent thinkers. We have a different student at the when you shift from 17 to 18. I have one of my own right now who's a senior. They are different. They want to get out there and be part of the world. When we talk about the independent thinkers, the independent students, we also have in there students that they don't necessarily want to sit in a classroom, which a concern would be that we would have increased disruptions to the educational process. And that's a major concern of the area principals that I'm here representing. The main focus, I think, should be around options, And I guess I'd like to quote Joel Lundeen. When I called him yesterday, he's the high school principal of Monticello. He said, I told him what I was coming to do here today, and I asked him, what are your thoughts? And he said, well, what you're talking about is creating options versus control. And I think he said it best. I think we need to take a look, or I would suggest the interventions be earlier in the school, in a student's tenure at schools. It's like thinking about medicine. Preventative medicine is far better than emergency surgery. And so I guess that's how we would take a look at that. Just some closing thoughts. I think we really need to clearly, or what really should be, I guess we should define the objective and the goal. What's really the outcome that's being proposed here? Is it to create better students? Is it to create better opportunities? Or is it just to create an age, a line that not all kids fit? Again, we need to create opportunities, not more control. Students are we talking about? They're independent individuals. Going back to keeping, if we keep it at 17, gather data for the next couple of years, and then take a look at what that data says. I guess I've never done this before, and I was asked at the last minute. I'm sorry if I'm jumping around here, but just gathered my thoughts here, and I just want to say that we have different types of students when they are 17 to 18. They're different individuals.
Thank you, Principal Dockendorf. I believe we have some members with questions. Representative Seltzer, did you have a question for the principal?
Thank
Excuse
you.
Me.
Yes, I did, and maybe for the MSBA representative also. You said many things that sparked some thoughts in me, and one of them is that there are different types of students, and the chair has brought to us examples of programs that are meeting the needs of these different types of students. We need to fund that so that I know that I'm sure you and others do some of that and want to do more of that already so that we keep those students engaged. I like what you said about prevention, earlier intervention so that these kids are engaged. That's all great. When we talk about, we don't want a 17-year-old doesn't want to be there anymore, how disruptive is that? And, children change as they get older, but I don't know how, my question is, how different is that from a 15-year-old who doesn't want to be there? And, when we think about it, I know I'm from a small town, and my grandparents and their peers, they went to school through eighth grade, and then they stopped, and they, went to work on the farm, or they went to work in town. So if we'd never had changed the law, we could be arguing that, eighth grade is good enough. So I'm just wondering if you could, comment on that and maybe answer that question, because I'm having a hard time. How is a, 15-year-old who doesn't want to be there that much different from a 17-year-old who doesn't want to be there?
Principal, very quickly, please.
Absolutely. Thank you. Madam Chair, I, too, am from a small town, Watkins, Minnesota, if you know where that is. And my father went to, finished school at sixth grade, went to work on the farm. He ended up being a colonel in the United States Marine Corps. A lot of it comes from in here. But as far as programs, there's a program out there right now that we've implemented that is just tremendous. We've partnered with the area manufacturing businesses. Remley, to be exact, is one supporter at this time, where we're getting kids out at the ages of 16 and 17, and they're earning school credit, they're earning money, and they're looking to be lifelong employees. And I'm not sure if I answered the complete question.
Ms. Bezenhoff, did you have a comment to make?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Seltzer, I think in this case I would maybe refer to students who may be dealing with either homelessness or mental health issues, that they may need that time away or in the place where they aren't able to be in school and may benefit from getting other help.
Representative Dabney, I think you're next on the list.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just primarily observe that the testimony, I think, has covered the waterfront here. As a high school dropout myself, I know that I made a bad choice, and I take full responsibility for it. But I also know what's true is, in ways subtle and not, I was pushed out. I wasn't a behavior problem in school. I wasn't disruptive, but I probably was just a pain and a distraction to have around. So, Representative Mariani, you're taking choices away from high school principals with this, the choice to push kids out who they don't want to have the programming for, they don't want to have around because they're a pain, they don't want to deal with the parents. And we need to consider whether we want to take that choice away from high school principals with this bill. I think on balance it's best we do. I think challenging the educational system to pick up the programs that are out there, the Check and Connect program, it's a national model, engaging students at a younger age, you know, just as the principal was saying, getting them the key resources so that they can build relationships and keep these kids in school. Schools aren't necessarily going to do that without some positive challenge from the legislature sometimes. And maybe this also goes back to the lack of school counselors in Minnesota. 49th in the nation, I think. I think we're up from 50th. So we can build on our momentum. But there are, we also last year did pass legislation to allow for targeted populations middle college experiences. And the fiscal note on that was because they expected more kids to graduate from high school. I couldn't have been prouder. I couldn't have been more pleased. But I do think it's worth challenging our schools to pick up in the interest of the kids, because while I may grow up in a rural area, we want them to have the choice to stay there and work in manufacturing. We also want them to have the choice to move if that's what they want to do. And thinking that simply if I grow up in a rural area and I want to go work on the farm, I don't need to complete high school is, I think, short-sighted for the kids. And I think we want to place the emphasis on the choices for kids. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Moran, last question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would like to just say I echo some of the comments of my Representative Dabney and Seltzer and their perspective around how we continue to engage kids in the educational system. You know, I heard you testify, said you have a child, a son or a daughter, who's 17. And, you know, as I think of as a parent who have a child who did have a child who was 17 or 18, if they had made a decision that they wanted to drop out of school and to say that's your choice, you know, or, you know, you really don't want to be there, would I have been open enough to say that's the choice that you have? You know, the law states that we're an adult at the age of 18. And so I know in my world, the perspective is that you will be under my guidance until you're 18. And I think that's the same perspective that we need to bring to the table when we look at our educational institutions, that we should be doing everything that we need to do to ensure that kids until the age of 18 are engaged in the educational system. There are many alternative paths that they can take. There's many alternative programs. You know, maybe we do need to invest in more counselors, more support for kids. And I really so often believe that we are past the days of where, you know, you're 14, you're 15, you're 16, you can drop out of school and go get a job, because that has consequences, lifelong consequences for that child, because we don't live in that world where we have to manufacturing jobs, or not everyone lives on a farm where we can just go and, you know, become a hand on a farm. And so, you know, I think you're pretty lucky. You know, you have 92% attendance at your school. You have a graduation rate of 85%. I mean, that is awesome. But when you have those kids who are disruptive, what alternative path do you have available for those kids? That's the question I have for you.
Principal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First thing I would say is I think there's a couple good points there. The counseling piece, I've been a strong advocate for that for many years. Also, as far as the graduation rate and everything else at Big Lake High School, we work on relationships. In 2007, I was a Minnesota Assistant Principal of the Year based on my work with creating relationships. So that's a valuable piece in talking about forcing kids out and not feeling welcomed, et cetera, et cetera. 100% in agreement with that. But going back to your question, I'm sorry.
What alternative, Madam Chair?
Well, yes, Representative Grant.
We work with a consortium of Wright Learning Center.
Yes.
We offer an alternative learning center. We offer Wright Technical School. We offer a couple new things that are just really hitting the ground running. We have youth apprenticeship. We have, and we've taken some kids who are considering heading out and being done. They're now working with the area manufacturers in jobs. We have, we're starting a CEO, youth entrepreneurship program next year. We have, I'm sorry, the other two escape me at this point.
That's okay. I know you're doing good work.
And so, Madam Chair,
your students have opportunities. Representative Moran.
So I would say that you have, as a principal, have invested greatly in keeping your children engaged in the educational system, knowing that they all learn differently and finding ways to meet their needs. But that is also a part of what I'm hearing you saying, is that you have made a commitment to ensure that they are engaged, getting their degree, and graduating to go on to do other things in life. And I would say that should be the commitment of the Minnesota School Board Association and schools in general around the state to find alternative programs and alternative path for our children. I'm going to call them children until they're 18, to be successful. So I just want to applaud. I always want to thank Representative Mariani for recognizing the need to increase the age from 17 to 18 and putting the pressure on our schools to do the right thing to ensure that our kids are graduating out of high school, because we know what the demands of today's society is on our young kids if they don't do that. And so we have to recognize that. We have to take some ownership of that. And I think that starts with us here at the legislature to move to a place where we are working to ensure that every child is successful and no child is left behind.
Thank you, Representative Moran. Members, at your places, you received, I think, four different handouts. Two of them, one from Buffalo High School and from the other from the Minnesota Association of Secondary School Principals, deal with the bill that we're hearing right now, House File 15. The other two are for the bill that we must get to. So with that, Representative Mariani, just a one-sentence closer, please.
Madam Chair, I appreciate the time you've given to this. I've been in your seat, and I know that, you know, managing the time is critically important. I just want to quickly say that this is not about control. This is about setting an expectation, a part of this body, for our systems to adjust and adapt perhaps at a much more rigorous pace than it is adjusting and adapting, precisely because we do think the well-being of our state and our society is at stake here. I think they're capable of doing it. I do think it's important for us to keep that pressure on, and I also think we should have a conversation about ways in which, beyond just setting the expectation, perhaps the state could also step up more in terms of resources so that Principal Duggendorf can have some additional tools in his tool bag to be able to work with these 17-year-olds. Madam Chair, thank you for the time this morning.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. The Chair removes Representative Mariani's motion that House File 15 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Members, we need to approve the minutes. Representative Wills, have you looked over the minutes? And will you move approval?
Yes, Madam Chair. And there were a couple of small corrections.
Thank you. Will you let Mr. Hellier know those, please? With that, Representative Wills moves approval of the minutes. Any discussion other than the technical changes she suggested? Hearing no discussion and no changes other than those, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, no. Motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. Members, with that, we go to probably the biggest bill of our day is House File 46. We welcome to the table Representative Aaron Murphy,
our former majority leader. Welcome, Representative Murphy. And Representative Mariani, would you move her bill, please?
Yes, Chair, I would move. And the motion, I think, here is just a motion for passage.
Representative Mariani, we're going to lay it over for possible inclusion.
So, Madam Chair, I would move House File 46 for passage and laying over for possible inclusion.
Thank you. Representative Mariani moves House File 46 for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Welcome to our committee, and please say your name for the record and begin your testimony of this very important piece of legislation.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. I am Representative Aaron Murphy from the Mighty 64 of St. Paul, and I'm grateful that you are taking time to hear House File 46, which I believe to be among the most significant proposals for consideration for this legislature. For too many years, we have discussed the promise of early learning. I served on the Early Childhood Committee with Representative Ryan Winkler in our very first term. And we heard much of the promise of early learning, the data to support it. Art Rolnick has made the economic case for early learning, and there's considerable agreement, both in the legislature and in our communities across Minnesota, about the value of early education for our kids, for their achievement, and for our future. With deficits behind us and our schools repaid, it is time to act on what we know. Minnesotans have long invested in the education of our children, knowing it propels their success and our future. Our fortunes rise when our youngest learners grow into well-educated, productive adults, ready to invent and to create and to lead. And despite our efforts to date, we have too many kids coming to school not ready to learn. And that's why I believe it is time for Minnesota to join the ranks of other states such as Wisconsin and Oklahoma and offer voluntary universal pre-K for all the kids in the state of Minnesota. Research confirms the long-term benefits of early education. High-quality pre-K programs have been shown to help close the achievement gap for children at high risk and to increase academic achievement, graduation rates, and college enrollment for students of all racial and economic backgrounds. But I suspect you already know that. And our testifiers, and we have six, so I'm going to be quick, they're going to elaborate on that for you and talk about the data and their experience. I know that I am here before the Education Committee, and I stand on the shoulders of many of you who have been doing this work for much longer than I, and many in our community who have worked hard to bring this issue into sharp relief for us and for our consideration. And honestly, I'm quite humbled to be here before you today to talk about this with you. I'm arguing for universal pre-K because I know it's a game changer, not only for our young kids, but also for Minnesota. And I also believe we need to invest further in early intervention from 0 to 3. And that is my experience both as a parent and as a nurse. We need to invest in quality childcare, like CCAP and Head Start and scholarships and home visiting and early childhood family education. We need those targeted interventions for our youngest children so they come ready to pre-K, ready to learn. I understand and appreciate that there is some tension between the idea of scholarships and universal pre-K, but from my perspective, they fit together. And we should do all that we can in this legislative session, a well-balanced budget and a surplus, to invest in our youngest learners, because I think it's one of the wisest investments we can make in our future. And I don't believe we should leave this legislature without completing that work. I support universal pre-K because I, like so many Minnesotans, know the power of education. And when you talk with Minnesotans all over the state, they trust that investment. They know that our history and our success to date rests in the investments that we've made in education. And I never hear people say, don't invest in our young learners. They know it is important. Some are suggesting that we should target this investment in pre-K. And I say this, we know kids by their zip codes, we know them by their income, we know by presumption that we can target and maybe solve the problem of the achievement gap. But if we look at things, as Representative Precia was talking yesterday in the Healthcare Committee, like adverse child events, the ACE score,
We can't necessarily identify kids just by poverty and just by their zip code. I think that the power of early education is strong enough that we should invest in it for everyone. It really should be universal. Our kids don't reside on a sliding scale. Our kids each deserve this opportunity, because in any home, a child can be at risk. And we have this opportunity this year in this legislature to make this wise investment going forward. The power of early education is clear. Let's make it available for all Minnesota kids all over the state of Minnesota. Its value is proven, and let's make this the year when we get it done. I want to call your attention to a couple of handouts. There's a letter from a teacher that I met from Crookston, and she sent a letter in support of this proposal and talks about why she thinks it's important there. And I also included a Star and Tribune editorial from a physician named Dr. Kotke, who is a constituent in the district I represent. And he writes eloquently about the idea that if we want to solve our health care crisis and the cost of health care, we must first invest in education. And I want to call that to your attention. And now for testifiers. First, we have the superintendent of the St. Paul Schools and her her new employee, Vicki Turner. Come on down.
And this is the way this will work. We'll hear from three of your testifiers, and then we'll move to three who have concerns so that we make sure we have this balance. And I encourage the testifiers to please follow our committee legislative assistant here to watch for time, because we'd like to keep your testimony as to the point as possible and under a time constraint, because we took so much time on a previous bill, which we needed to. I don't want to slight you. So welcome to the committee, and let's begin with your testifier to your left, please.
And Madam Chair, clarifying question?
Yes.
We'll do three, and then three, and then the balance, if we have the time, can come and testify.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Good morning. My name is Vicki Turner. I'm the Assistant Director of the Office of Early Learning with the St. Paul Public Schools. Thank you for having me this morning. You have the handout.
Yes, we do.
I was going to do a PowerPoint, but I forgot my doggone. So as Superintendent Silver stated, we have 39,000 students. I'm speaking from my PowerPoint.
Thank you.
And I'm proud to be part of this early learning environment. Currently, we have 1,800 students enrolled in pre-K. The data that I'm sharing today was from October, where we had about 15,000 kids enrolled. We had over almost 500 kids on a waiting list. 300 of those kids were waiting for full-day programming, which we only offered that in four sites. Our pre-K programs are very effective. We have highly qualified staff, standard-based curriculum, instructional model that align with our K-5 early childhood workshop. We also have standard-based assessments that we use. We have licensed parent educators that have worked with 980 parents last year. 655 were served by bilingual or bicultural parent educators. We also work with our principals and providing professional development with principals on our model. And also we have support staff that support classroom for and social-emotional supports for the children. We couldn't do this work without our partners. Our partners include the McKnight Foundation, United Way, Minnesota Reading Corps, Target, and Generation Next. We do know our program is successful based on a McKnight-funded study done by the Wilder Research. There were definite advantages for students who attended our pre-credit program. The program began in 2008, and the study tracked these children from pre-K into grade 3. St. Paul Public Schools pre-K students outperformed their peers who did not attend pre-K. The first cohort reached third grade in 2011-2012 with gains that remained from their pre-K experience. I just want to say that most of the kids are on target. They remain on target. I only have a minute left. I think early pre-K does a great job of closing the opportunity gap and helping these kids become successful readers by third grade. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Turner. Very briefly, Superintendent Silva, welcome back.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the board. After you heard the data, I can tell you the program is started because of McKnight provide us with funding as part of the best research that says early intervention, that 2008. And right now, with the 1,800 students, what we find is that over 50% of our students do not speak English when they come. And that's St. Paul, is our reality. And many of the families, they do not put their students in a daycare because it's not their tradition, but they do put them in the bus with their siblings to come to our schools. And what it is so great about the program in St. Paul, and I know Anoka has something very similar, is that they're part of our schools. It's not like a center within a center. They're part of the whole school. The principal supervises everything. They're part of the event. So the students are getting a whole year of early interventions. And in this year, for the first time, we have done an inclusion model. The students who have special needs were served at their homes, and sometime if they attended to a center or early childhood programs like ECFE. But now they're served, and we have a priority for them in our schools with the other siblings. And what we are seeing is sometimes the special need is language development, is speech and services, and they are coming to us with those needs, and they are now in almost March very much being able to speak and have many of their disabilities being served differently. And that self-esteem for the students has been an amazing boost. And our students also, and the families also get the opportunity to have interpreters and family who understand their culture and language. And our last group of refugees that we have gotten is from Burma, and they speak Korean or Burmese. And the families, at the beginning, they were a little bit apprehensive to send them so young to school, but you can see how the families have loved the fact that their children are going to school. When you go on the first week of school, I just tell you, those pre-K teachers, we had to do a monument or something. I know I couldn't teach pre-K. The kids are running, and then they're just like, oh, my God, how am I going to do it? You go now, and you would not even know that they're pre-K because they have the rituals and routines, and they're already starting to read. They're already feeling comfortable with books and materials. So if we talk about early intervention and investment, especially for a second language learner or special ed student, which is the majority of our kids, that we poor special ed and ELL students, it would be a great asset for the district. And we are lucky to fund this program through our referendum dollars, since some of the taxpayers are really doing a big effort. And again, thank them for putting the dollars into something that we know is successful. And again, you're welcome to attend.
Thank you very much, Superintendent Silva. I'm getting carried away here with elevating you to the legislature. And then our next testifier.
Wait. Madam Chair.
Welcome.
Steve Kerr. I'm the Executive Director for Community and Government Relations for the Anoka-Hennepin School District and representing the Minnesota Community Ed Association today. I'm here to tell you the Anoka-Hennepin story. Essentially, we have about 1,200 students that are in our pre-K program. In particular, I'm going to focus a bit on our most intensive version of that, which is a four-day-a-week program supported with both student and family supports and transportation. Transportation is critical for us in terms of creating persistence among our students. I'd like to give you the bottom line success story out of this is that, especially in our targeted program, we have those are the kids most likely not to be starting kindergarten ready with their peers. We focus on students of high poverty, EL, special needs students, and those make up that most intensive group. The success story is that 90% of those kids, based on pre- and post-tests, are ready for kindergarten. And I think to add to the data story, if you will, Last year in our school district, we had to redesign our entry benchmarks because there were so many kids coming in at a higher level that their trajectory is just coming at higher, and we had to raise that benchmark. In addition, I asked for some follow-up studies to look at what are our exit scores looking like for these kids coming out of kindergarten. What I'm seeing is that those kids are with their peers. They're in the middle of their peer group. When you look at comparing their economic profile with similar group of economic profile, they're 13% higher in math and 10% higher in reading. So as you can imagine, flowing through a system and the economics of that and what that means for intervention for those students is a great savings for the Canopin School District. I'm often asked by folks like you, how do we do those kinds of things? And it's not just one thing. It's multiple kinds of things. We have trained all of our early education supervisors and our teachers through the Minnesota Principals Academy. We've worked hard to align our curriculum pre-K through 3. We do staff development with our pre-K teachers and our kindergarten teachers. We've just done a lot of things, outreach to the families at home. Our teachers go visit with families a couple of times a year in their homes to get an understanding of where the children are coming from and to work with the parents and try to empower the parents as the first primary teacher of the student, and to try to give them some tools that they can use. So if you go to the Canopin website, you'll see little YouTube videos that we do for things that parents can do at home on math and reading and those kinds of things. So it's not just one thing. It's a lot of things that we've done in order to help those students be successful in our system. So I'll be brief because I know you're on a time
schedule.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next, I'd like to hear from three who have concerns. Three who have concerns: Erica Moss, Stephen Priscilla Williams, and Steve Williams. If you would come forward to express your concerns so we can hear from you. I know you all traveled from work, and then we'll resort to testifiers. Anyone with concerns, please come forward. Sir, will you say your name for the record and begin, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Steve Williams, and my wife, Priscilla, and I are the owners of Especially for Children Child Care Centers, and we have 8 locations throughout the Twin Cities area. It was an enterprise begun by Priscilla in 1976 and born out of a passion for providing a wonderful experience for young children. We are in concert, I think, with many of the sentiments that have been expressed so far, in that I think we are all believers in the value of a high-quality pre-school education. Our concern is more in how we deliver on and fulfill that promise. To do that, I'd like to share with you some thoughts that we have of a 39-year perspective of preschool in Minnesota, and looking at the delivery system that has evolved and matured. Before I do that, however, I'd like to beg your indulgence if we seem a little excited and scattered this morning. As of 6:32, we have a new grandson in our family.
Oh, nice.
A very exciting event for us, and we were a little worried because he was 2 weeks overdue, and we thought he might be reading the weather reports and deciding not to emerge until spring sometime, but we are glad to have him with us. As I said, I'd like to share a little bit of our perspective about the child care delivery system in the state of Minnesota. There are, I think, 4 key elements to this, the first of which are facilities. According to the state's website, there are nearly 1,700 Rule 3 licensed facilities in the state of Minnesota. They are intentionally located to be convenient for both home and work, depending upon their circumstance. And together, they have over 112,000 capacity. These were built thoughtfully, either from the ground up or remodeled. Especially with the areas of room size, restrooms, indoor and outdoor play spaces in mind. The second component, and obviously the most important one, is staff. Extrapolating on our own experience, I would think that we have perhaps as many as 30,000 individuals who are employed by these centers in the state. These are hardworking people who are dedicated to making good things happen in the lives of young children. They meet the state's educational and experience guidelines. And in addition, they undertake continuing education to stay current in the field and advance themselves according to the state's qualification criteria. Another key element is that we have in place a tier of standards. The most basic is the required licensing standard from the state of Minnesota, which focuses chiefly on facilities, equipment, policies, and staff qualifications. Minnesota's standards in this area have been well regarded nationally for many years as being both rigorous and appropriate. In addition to that, there are voluntary standards that are both administered and validated by outside agencies. These are national accreditation standards. They tend to focus on staff and child interactions, which are obviously critical to educational outcomes. Added to the mix is parent aware. Unlike national accreditation, which is either a pass or fail circumstance, this provides a scale of outcomes and ratings which serve to encourage and motivate centers to move up the quality ladder. And finally, I think another key element is support resources which are in place. There are public health nurses who visit centers to assist infant and toddler staff in the implementation of best practices. There are outside agencies such as Washburn Center for Children, St. David Schools, and others who provide evaluation and placement for children with developmental or behavioral challenges. We collaborate extensively also with the public schools in this same area. Taken together, these elements define a delivery system which serves our children and families well. There are language and culturally based options. Parents can also choose among curriculum approaches, including things such as Montessori, Creative Curriculum, Reggio Emilia, and High Scope. I believe that as parents, educators, taxpayers, and legislators, our responsibility is to allocate our resources in a thoughtful way which maximizes the benefit to those served. We can best do this, we feel, by utilizing a proven delivery system already in place and focusing any new resources on tuition subsidies and scholarships.
Mr. Williams, could you be finishing, please?
Okay. We think that this is the best approach toward good stewardship of our resources, and that we would recommend funding the family and not the institution. And I would encourage all of us to do what we can to achieve that goal.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Welcome, Ms. Moss. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Erica Moss from Parent Aware for School Readiness. I appreciate that you all are taking on this topic today, and thank you for your work in the area of early childhood education. It's an incredibly important area to be working on. That's why we exist. We feel like doing two things will put Minnesota on the right track to doing well by our youngest learners. And the first is to put low-income kids first, and the second is to keep a system fair and flexible. Putting low-income children first obviously addresses Minnesota's shameful achievement gaps, and it helps us prioritize children who are often left behind. It's also the area where there's the greatest return on investment. Advocates often cite return on investment 7-1, 16-1. That return on investment comes from investing in children who are likely to incur future costs. You don't achieve the same kind of return on investment from investments made in children not likely to incur costs in the future. There are about 15,000 children that we estimate now, 3- and 4-year-olds, who are on a waiting list, unable to access what they need. And so we'd like to prioritize those children first. The second point about structuring a system so that it's fair for providers and flexible for parents. Fairness dictates that any provider who can do the job ought to be given an equal opportunity to serve children, just as they currently do. We believe that equal opportunity, not earmarks, should be the guiding factor in state investment. We also believe that parents need and deserve a broad range of high-quality options to find the provider that best fits their child and their life circumstances, just as they currently do. And finally, many children and parents, same point, want different types of programs for their children. So in closing, we would encourage the committee to invest in pre-K, but to make sure that the committee prioritizes low-income children first and structures investments so that they are fair and flexible. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Moss. Did I see one other in the audience who wanted to testify with concerns? If not, thank you very much, both of you. We have John Millenhagen, are you here? You've come from Recorded Cold Spring and you wanted to speak in support, is that correct?
Yes.
So please sit down, and if we have no others with concerns, we'll resort to those with support. Rules is coming in here at 10, and you noticed on Tuesday they like to get in here, so keep that in mind, members. Welcome to the committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
John Millerhagen. I'm the executive director of Minnesota Elementary School Principals Association, and today I have Andy Kubis from Bloomington and Eric Skansen from Recorded.
Where is he?
Thank you, House Education Innovation Committee, for the work that you're doing. I'll be real quick. We're here today to support House File 46 and would quickly like to share results from a quality aligned school-based pre-K program called Kinder Prep. And secondly, we would like to share with you the excitement and opportunity that elementary principals across Minnesota are making a commitment to lead pre-K programs. Andy?
Will you say your name for the record, please, and begin?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Andy Kubis. I'm the principal at Valley View Elementary School in Bloomington. Just to paint the picture, Valley View is a traditional K-5 school, about 540 students. Our free and reduced lunch is about 90%, and about 55% of our families and students are learning English as their second language. And so as I took over Valley View 4 years ago, one of the things that we knew that we needed to capture was our early learners. And so with the help of the school district, we put in place a program called Kinder Prep for four-year-olds. We currently have 68 four-year-olds at our school who come for a half-day experience. And the data that we have, albeit only 2 years old, is pretty significant. Just a couple things I'll touch on for the sake of brevity. The first is what we call our EKA, or Early Kindergarten Assessment. Before we had our Kinder Prep model, the amount of students who passed that, the number was at 65%. It's a pretty simple test about number recognition, letter recognition, early literacy skills. Since our Kinder Prep program, we've gone to 81 and then 83% of kids passing that early kindergarten assessment. The second piece of data that I'll submit for you talks about maybe the socialization of four-year-olds in a school setting. And so one way, and albeit there's certainly holes in it, but it's what we use, is behavior data about what a teacher decides or administrator decides to document as a behavior. Before the Kinder Prep model, the kindergarten students had 106 and 107 behavior referrals for the last 2 years, respectively. After Kinder Prep, we literally cut it in half to 53. That talks a lot to me about students being ready for school, being ready to understand how to function, how to, as we say, play school. The last thing that I'll talk about is the amazing connection we get to make with families. And I think that's probably something that we can't necessarily put a number on, but to have engaging families of kids who are 4 years old, given the demographics that I talked about that we're fortunate to serve, with the amount of transiency, building a relationship with families and having them stay at our school because we've made that relationship. Representative earlier talked at the last bill, talked about making connections and early interventions. This is early interventions, and it's making a difference.
Thank you, sir. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we have three parents who took off work and came, and I must honor their trip here and let them come to the table. So if you would step aside and let these parents speak. I apologize.
Thank you very much.
This is not good. Thank you very much, gentlemen. These are parents, I think two parents and one preschool teacher who would like to lend their support. So please say your name for the record and tell us why you think this is a good idea to enact into law. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thanks for having me. My name is Nate Mathias. I'm a pre-K teacher in the Wayzata Public Schools, and I'm also the father of a four-year-old son. And I'm here to express my support for House File 46, a universal all-day pre-K. I've been teaching preschool for 3 years now and been a teacher for eight. I've been most amazed by the growth of our students. I kind of was led to preschool by a series of family emergencies and things, teaching secondary school before that and special ed, and finding amazing growth in the kids, and it's led me to become so passionate about the issue and making sure it reaches every kid in Minnesota. Just to speak on a few things, I think one thing, talking to the kindergarten teachers, I find the biggest issue they're dealing with is preparedness, from kids who haven't had any pre-K program to kids who've gone to even a three-year-old program. And my concern is, being a teacher myself, I can't even afford to send my own son to my own program. It's 2 days a week would be the cost of our daycare for the whole week. And so I'm in a situation where my son was not going to be provided those benefits that either people on the low end of the socioeconomic spectrum or those who are well off can get their chance at pre-K. And so I'd like to see all kids get a chance to have that opportunity and not just kind of shifting things around.
Thank you, sir. I'd like to call on a parent now, if we have a parent here. Would you please say your name for the record and begin?
Yes, my name is Monica Hawks, and I'm a parent of four beautiful girls, two in high school and two in elementary school. All four of my children went through the St. Paul Public Schools pre-K program, and I cannot say enough about the teachers, as Superintendent Silva mentioned. They are a godsend. But my girls came to kindergarten prepared. They came ready to understand that you get in line and how to ride the bus and how to sit still for story time and what a book was. And by the end of their pre-K education, they had well over 100 sight words that they were able to read. That's something that I, as a parent, would love to be able to teach them, but I'm not sure that I have the ability that they have. And it is, you know, I'm a middle-class mom of four, but I can say the same thing. I don't know that we would be able to afford the program as we would like to for our kids.
Thank you very much. And our last testifier, please say your name for the record.
My name is Becky Meinhardt, and I work at St. Paul Public Schools at Paul and Sheila Wellstone. And I actually work in an all-day pre-K, which is very unusual in St. Paul. And when I was told I was going to turn to all-day, I felt I was really torn, because I felt like it was the industrialization of childhood and that children should be home with their parents during the day, for at least part of the day, and come to me for part of the day. So we used our skepticism to build a day for kids that really is enjoyable and they want to be there. We use targeted play and direct instruction, and the kids love it, and I love it, I have to say. I don't want to go back to half day anymore, because my kids are doing so well. I have 60% of them ready for kindergarten. 60% have met the guidelines that we have for kindergarten readiness, and I still have 5 months to get the rest of the 40% there. And it's just an amazing program, and the kids are doing... And I have kids who did it last year, because last year was my first year of all day. And my kids that went to kindergarten, my friends, the kindergarten teachers, they can pick them out. They don't even have to ask me who my kids were. They know exactly who my kids were because they're ready to be in kindergarten.
Thank you very much. And members, we'll hold this over to Tuesday, this House File 46, so that you can ask questions of Representative Murphy. And if there are other testifiers who return, who are usually here, we'll hear from them. With that, members, this meeting is adjourned.